Come on, let's get going now.
From KMOX Sports.
We're primed and ready.
All day, baby.
Man, let's go.
This is the Graybar Sports Open Live. Graybar, your distributor for electrical and datacom needs on 104.1 FM, KMOX.
All right, here we go. Welcome in. It's Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name's Matt Pauly. You know, we're going to be with you a lot here moving forward. All week long, we've got shows. We'll have almost full shows Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then we'll have full shows on Thursday and Friday. This is the first time in a while we've had this much Sports Open Line on an everyday basis. And it's like this transitional period where, because once Cardinal baseball season ends, then we're doing a lot of Sports Open Line. But we've got this week here where the Cardinal season is still going, but they're going to play West Coast games for the next 3 days, and then they're off on Thursday. They're going to play a day game in Chicago coming up on Friday. So with that, here we are, and we're going to take you all the way until, what's pregame time, 7:45? Is that right? 7:45 for the pregame tonight. As I ask Kyle Sixtun, he gives me the answer. Now he's thinking, do we get that right? I can look it up. Anyways, it'll be in that. Is it 7:40 or 7:45? We'll be with you until then. Those little details don't matter. We can figure it out as we get closer to that time. We've got a lot coming up. Today's one of my favorite shows. We do it every year. We bring in Stan McNeil, senior writer, Cardinals Magazine. The Cardinals do a yearbook every single year. And it's really cool. Every year they just focus in on one single topic, and that's what the yearbook is. And this year the focus is on Willie McGee, and I loved reading everything in it. So there's a current interview that Willie did. Then they run two previous interviews that he did earlier on in his career. They go back into the archives and run a couple stories that were written about Willie previously in his life. There's kind of shout outs that are sent to him from individuals who he has been around in his baseball life. Ozzie Smith writes the foreword. It was really good. I had so much fun just sitting down and reading through the magazine. It's not a magazine, it's a yearbook. It's from the Cardinals magazine people. It feels like a magazine when you're reading it, but it's that doesn't do justice to call it a magazine. It is much more than that. Once again, no pun intended, the Cardinals publication staff have absolutely hit a home run with the yearbook. So Stan's going to be with us in about 10 minutes or so, and we're going to talk to him about everything that went into it. We'll share some of what Willie had to say, including sort of what he's up to now and what that looks like in his current role in the organization. Talk through what led to him. One of the premises of the yearbook is that Willie is the most popular. I don't know if I don't have the magazine, the yearbook in front of me. I got to run in the office and grab it. I don't remember if the cover says most popular outfielder or most popular Cardinal of the last 50 years, but the idea behind it that when Willie's around and he gets announced, he gets the biggest ovations, that nobody else gets an ovation like Willie. And he has become an incredibly popular individual for Cardinals fans. So we're going to talk all things Willie McGee with Stan McNeil, and we are going to do that again. That's going to start now, a little bit less than 10 minutes is when Stan is going to join us here on the program. We'll also talk some Mizzou football with Gabe DeArmond. He's going to join us at about 7:05. The big story today is the comments that Nolan Arenado made yesterday, and I want to talk through that. And I think we're at a point now where we just need to be honest about where this thing is going. If your belief is that the Cardinals should hold on to Nolan Arenado and that he should remain at third because he's a future Hall of Famer and he still plays really, really good defense and he can be a great influence on the young players, yada, yada, yada. If that is your premise, I'm not even going to argue that premise with you. There are a lot of valid aspects to that premise. But one of my big things is knowing what's going to happen, knowing the truth and dealing with it. And I guess, is there a scenario where the Cardinals don't work out a trade for Arenado? Yeah, because it happened this year. I can remember being on these very airwaves and saying, man, it's a 99% chance or a 90% chance or a 90. Like, I don't remember the exact number that I gave, But I made it very clear that I would be beyond shocked if Arenado did not get traded. And then what happened? He didn't get traded. And he played the entire season with the team. So is there a scenario where that plays out again? I guess so. But sometimes you've also got to listen to what's being said. And for Arenado to be as open as he was yesterday about, it looks like this is the end, it probably should be, he's blocking some other individuals, they're going through a problem. Like everything that he said after the game yesterday when he was honored before the game, it just yells and screams, okay, everybody's really on the same page now that this isn't going to be a scenario where he sticks around. So you can sit here and argue with me and contend that the Cardinals are making a mistake, that they need to bring Arenado back. You can say all those things. You can believe all those things. But we are going to sit here and speak in true scenarios that could play out. And I think it became very clear yesterday that Nolan Arenado's time with the St. Louis Cardinals is winding down. I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't know if he's going to be less, picky when it comes to who he would accept a trade to. I don't know if there's basically an understanding that if they don't work out a deal, they're gonna let him go. Like I don't know what it looks like. I have no information when it comes to that, but I think we can be fully understanding of the fact that this is probably going to be a situation where Arenado, they're going to move him somehow, some way. He is not going to be a Cardinal come opening day next year. I feel like I've gone into a time machine, though, because those are the exact same things I was saying before this season got started. And so I feel like I have to keep throwing this caveat out there that that's what we were saying earlier, and it didn't really work out that way. So I don't really know how that's all going to end up playing out. But here we are, and it just definitely looks like Arenado's going to be done. We'll talk more about that coming up in just a little while. Up next, though, we are going to talk with Stan McNeil. He's going to join us in his studio as we're going to talk through the Cardinals yearbook, which is available, all things Willie McGee. Stan joins us in just a few moments right here on KMOX. It's Great Bar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. I was saying earlier, this is always one of my favorite shows we do every year. Stan McNeil, senior writer, Cardinals Magazine, Cardinals Publications, is always gracious enough to come in studio and talk through the yearbook every year. And this year's yearbook is awesome. It's all about Willie McGee, Forever 51, a salute to the most beloved Cardinals of the last 50 years, Willie McGee, Cardinals 2025 yearbook. It is awesome. People can buy it. And I think after this conversation, you're going to want to get a copy. Stan, it's great to see you. How are you?
I'm great, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
How much fun was this, putting this one together?
Well, talking with Willie, I got to interview Willie a bunch, and not just Willie, but people who are close to Willie, like Willie's oldest brother and Willie's best friend since high school. So their thoughts are in there, too. But that's always fun to get to talk to people who know Willie that you don't usually hear from.
So it's really cool because you've got like three interviews with Willie, and two of them are from previous years, so you can kind of catch how he was feeling in that time. There's some pieces that had previously been published that are republished,
yep,
all about Willie. And then you get into the toast to Willie, where a lot of people share their thoughts on him. And there's a question and answer that you have with him. It said in it, it was over the course of 2 days. So just kind of take me through that, where you were at, how that worked out, and what it was like spending so much time with him going through so many things.
No, that's great. That's great. It was fun. We had, it took us a little while to kind of get the interview set up. Willie's, was in a new role this season, kind of traveling around to the affiliates. So once he knew his schedule, he was going to be in Jupiter at the end of, I think it was late April. He was going down to work with, some of the young minor leaguers, the young prospects. So we set that up, and Willie was out on the Marlins backfield watching a game between the Cardinals and the Marlins, complex league or rookie leagues. And so they told me in the office he was there. I just strolled on back to the backfield. Willie had his golf cart. We got saw me. We, you know, had an embrace and headed back to the clubhouse, and he talked for a couple of hours that day up in the conference room, you know, in the Jupiter complex. And then the next day we got up, and Willie had, you know, Willie was working, and so we weren't quite sure what we were going to, what the schedule was going to be like. And, you know, Willie's not known for being a wanting to talk about himself, yeah. Especially he's not a big talker, especially when it comes to talking about himself. But that morning, he was about 10 o'clock. I got a text from Willie saying, hey, I'm free. You want to talk some more? So I said, heck yeah. So I got dressed and rushed over to the ballpark, and we talked for another couple of hours, you know. So it was about him, about the game, about his career and everything. But, you know, and the one thing about Willie that everybody knows is he's so genuinely humble, and it is just so legit. That is Willie.
Yeah, a few things really struck me that I wanted to get your thoughts on from the current day interview. First off, I was struck by the fact that of all his awards, whether it's MVP or World Series, they're boxed up. A lot of them somebody else has. Like these things, he views them very much as just, you know, things. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, you know, I mean, the way he looks at it is there were awards that were kind of given to him, and he doesn't know exactly how they were presenting, you know, who voted for him or anything. The ones that Willie, you know, the awards, or not awards, but just the moments that really meant the most to Willie was just when teammates would say something. I mean, he told me that after his last game in at Busch Stadium, what meant the most to him was Jack Buck being at his locker after the game, waiting for him just to say, you know, congratulate him on a great career and everything. Willie said, hey, for him to come and be waiting for me like that, for Willie McGee, that meant something.
Not many players in the history of the Cardinals organization were like two different guys, because in his first stint, he's an MVP. He's a great player. He's leading the team to the World Series, so part of great teams. In his second stint, not that those teams weren't good, that was right as La Russa was coming in and everything, but he's more of a role player, a bench player, a guy who, you know, does the small things. He has two very unique tenures with the Cardinals.
Yeah, and that second one, you know, he kind of came in as to be veteran mentor-like, and then his first season, 96, he ended up playing quite a bit because of injuries, and, you know, Mark Sweeney, who's doing play-by-play sometimes now for Cardinals games on FanDuel, he was on that 96 team, and he told me that he thinks Willie was the MVP of that team, just for the way he brought everyone together, and for the way he was always kind of coming through in the clutch. And if you remember, that team, you know, came close to going to the World Series.
Game 7, Atlanta. That's my favorite Cardinal team of all time, because that's like my first team where I really fell in love with baseball. So I loved that night. Like, that game 7, really game 6 and 7 against Atlanta, it still stings me to this day. As a fan, there's no moment that maybe stings me more than what happened in 1996.
Yeah, and I'm sure that the players on that team feel the same way.
And you talk about the drama, and Ozzie wrote the foreword. We'll get more about that in a second. But Ozzie's on that team. Ozzie's got the feud with Tony. I've talked to some other members of that 96 team. I think there was a lot of stuff going on behind closed doors with that team that a lot of fans were not privy to. So that makes somebody like Willie that much more important.
Exactly, because Willie, as you know, was in the clubhouse. He was the guy. He was just the glue. You know, he wasn't going to be the one jumping up and down and yelling, but he was there. He was a pro, and he would keep everyone in line just by being Willie.
So his role now is, like you said, he goes to the minor league affiliates. He works with younger guys. This is his first year in that. He had been on the major league coaching staff before. I don't know if I took the context of it correctly or not, so you can correct me. But at one point in the interview, to paraphrase, basically said he likes his current role because he feels like these young guys are going to listen to him. Like, yeah, there's a chance for a more kind of, you know, devoted audience. I don't know if he's saying that the big league guys weren't listening to him, but it certainly feels like that audience he has with these young guys is very notable.
No, the big league guys did listen to him. I mean, he talked about how much he enjoyed working with Victor Scott II and Jordan Walker. But the thing about being in the big leagues is Willie was on the staff for what, eight years, and his title was coach. It wasn't first base coach. It wasn't, outfield coach. It was coach. So I think that, and this is just kind of my take on it, but I think that didn't allow Willie kind of his own real lane for coaching. So he was there for everybody, but he was always not really sure how to help best. And so in the role he was in this year, he went to, he went to Springfield, for example, and Patrick Anderson, the manager, said, Willie, just, do what you do. Just be you. And so Willie would just kind of sit around and hang out, watch guys the first day. And then as he's there, he would spend about a week at each affiliate. A couple of days later, he would say that the guys would start feeling comfortable and come up to him and start asking questions. And, and these guys, even though Willie hadn't played for 20, 26, 27 years, they knew, know who he is, know what he accomplished. And he definitely says because of that, they listened to him, He really just loves working with those young guys. I mean, that came so clear in the interview. You'd be asking him a question about, something that happened 10 or 15 years ago, and he would have a way of bringing it back to working with these young guys and teaching. That's what he loves to do.
We're talking with Stan McNeil. We're talking through the Cardinals 2025 yearbook, Forever 51, a salute to the most beloved Cardinal of the last 50 years, Willie McGee. We'll take a break, and we'll continue on with Stan coming up in just a moment. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
It is the Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauley. Great to have you with us. We are doing our annual conversation in studio with Stan McNeil from Cardinals Publications, talking through the Cardinals 2025 yearbook, a salute to the most beloved Cardinal of the last 50 years, Willie McGee. I love the premise. At one point, you mentioned the fact that if you were able to take the all-time decibel levels that are a result of cheers over the last however many years, Willie McGee is probably responsible for the highest number of decibels. I thought that was a cool illustration of it.
I mean, that just shows his popularity. And this is a guy who hadn't played, like we said, in 20, 25, 26 years. And yet, when he's introduced for the home opener, he's going to get the loudest ovation. It just seems like that's happened. I mean, even when Yachty was there, when Albert was there, Willie McGee.
Yeah. Still. Just remarkable. Just absolutely remarkable. You asked him about his Mount Rushmore of Cardinals instructors, and I thought it was a cool list that he gave.
Yeah, you'll have to remind me on who's on that.
So I know Dave Ricketts is on it.
Dave Ricketts,
Jose
who he
Kendo.
Loved. Dave Ricketts, the famous story is when Willie got traded over from the Yankees, there was a coach that Willie prefers not to name who Willie had, he had an unorthodox batting stance, batting style. And one of the coaches right away was going to start messing with it. And Dave Ricketts, who had been told by Whitey to not let anyone mess with Willie McGee, went over to the coach and said, hey, let the kid be. And, Willie is forever indebted to that because, Willie just he did have an unorthodox hitting style. And if they had made him conform, he's not sure what would have happened.
But to his point, he said, it doesn't matter how you start, it matters
that's
how you finish.
How you finish, yep. And, another one that people might not expect is Jim Riggleman was a favorite coach of Willie's. And this is kind of typical Willie. He was saying that Riggleman didn't really even have to say anything, but one time Willie was really struggling and, in a slump. And when you're in a slump, no one likes to talk to you. You feel all alone and you're down. And he said he was just sitting there one time and Riggleman came up to him and said, hey, you probably came back too soon from this hamstring. You're going hard all the time. You're going to be fine. And Willie said that just kind of gave him confidence that someone knew what was going on. And Riggleman has been one of his favorites since then.
He evidently added a few heads to Mount Rushmore because in addition to those, mentioned Jose Kendo, mentioned Whitey, mentioned Red Channings, and also mentioned Mike Schilt.
Yeah, he liked Mike Schilt, working with Schilty and all those guys. And Willie worked for Schilty, he worked for Mike Matheny, and he worked for Ollie. So he had some experience working for different managers, and he enjoyed that.
He's throughout the conversation, just his upbringing is a big part of it. You mentioned his humility. His father was a pastor. The Christian upbringing is a big part of it. And it's pretty incredible. He's been married to his wife for what, almost 40 years. He's just a good dude.
And that's the thing. I mean, which I think is part of the reason that all the attention gets to him. It makes him nervous. You know, one thing he was telling me is that, you know, when they take the lap around the stadium, inside the stadium on the home opener, he says he just does not like that. It makes him feel so uncomfortable. He appreciates the love and everything, but just he said it just makes him feel anxious, you know. Mm-hmm. And I totally can understand that after being around him.
On the faith side of things, he mentioned that his mom told him when he got called up in 82 that Cardinals are going to win the World Series. And he said, you know, sometimes Christian people prophesize. So Willie's mom knew the moment he got called up that the Cardinals were going to be World Series champions.
And that no one else really could have predicted that at that time, I don't think.
No, it's a fun story. The 85 season, how proud is he of that? Because from a statistical standpoint, that was the best year of his career.
It was, you know, and the one thing I ask him about that is like, Why was that so much better than the other seasons, you know? Why? Because the next season, I think his average went down probably close to 100 points. And the one thing that you might think about, but I really hadn't thought about that much, was injuries, you know? And 86, the year after 85, when Willie, you know, set all the records, he was playing with a bad knee, you know? And so that, but he played. He said he played through it, ended up having surgery after the 86 season. But that, you know, you don't really realize how much these guys play when they're not at 100%. And, you know, back in that day, guys did not like to go to the training room because mm-hmm. they wanted to be in the lineup. And you know, and Willie was a product of that environment all the way.
The old school baseball people always say, like, the number one rule is stay out of the trainer's room.
Yep. And Jose Oquendo told me that that was the one thing Willie told him when he came here. And it ended up working out because Jose got to play second base for some reason. But Jose appreciated Willie telling him that too.
I'm not trying to give everything away from the interview. I'm really not. So I'll leave some stuff out. But a couple more anecdotes that just thought were awesome. When talk about his decision on when to go ahead and call it a career, he had mentioned the fact that he had a hard time sleeping at night, especially when things were not going well. And there was a point in time late in his career where things were not going well, and he got a full night's sleep. And that was an indication to him that maybe he didn't have that same edge anymore.
Exactly. You know, but again, what's kind of interesting about that is when Willie came back in 96, I don't think he really knew how long he was going to stay, how much longer he was going to play. And I think after every year, it was a story. Mm-hmm. Willie going to come back next year? Willie going to come back? And finally, in 99, he decided not to because he had lost the edge. But if you talk to people, like Tony La Russa is one, and his good buddy Jarvis Brown is another, that they say that Willie could have played a couple more years if he had wanted to, you know, but he just, like you say, he just had kind of lost the edge.
You think of him as being very agreeable, very respectful, things like that. But the one story that comes out in this where maybe he wasn't so much was him wanting to have a green light to steal bases and basically being told if you're caught, it's going to cost you $50 and a fine, and him going ahead and stealing some bases anyways.
Yeah, that was early in his career when he was still in the Yankee system. You know, at that time, it was really hard to move up in the Yankee system. And, you know, Willie had a couple of good years, but still wasn't moving up. And then he got hurt again, played through it, and actually got sent down from AA to single A. And at that point, he said, hey, I'm going to just play my game and we'll see what happens. And that kind of worked out well for him.
Last thing from the actual interview part, and then we'll let everybody read everything else. But the answer, I literally laughed out loud when I read this. You asked him if he'd like to have like a Little League field named after him. And he said no, but explain his reason for saying no. It's classic.
It is. It's great. I mean, but you would think Willie, you know, okay, he doesn't really want a field named after him because he's so humble. That was kind of what I thought, you know. And I'm talking to him about it a little bit, and he says, "No, they can't do that." You know, I'd be there every day. I'd be so worried about keeping the field in good condition. You know, yeah. I've been down that road before because Willie, you know, after he retired as a player and still does to this day in Oakland, he's out there working on ball fields, you know, and helping coach. So, yeah, if you named put his name on a ball field, Willie would have to make sure it's major league quality, and he knows how much time that would take.
Amazing pride that he could not have a little league field that had his name on it that did not, you know, reach the highest standard, so much so that he helped out with a JUCO in California where he was doing the exact same thing, and his players there got to see him out there working on the field.
Exactly. You know, I mean, we're talking about he was putting in sprinklers, you know, not just mowing and dragging the infield, but he's putting in sprinklers and doing everything, you know. And yeah, when you see Willie McGhee doing that, if you're a 18, 19-year-old JUCO baseball player, that I think that's going to have an impact on you.
There's two other from the other interviews, like going back, what struck you now knowing everything you know about Willie and reading some of his words that were said during a previous point in his life?
He's has not changed would be the first thing I would say. You know, I mean, he's just been as humble and as genuine through that. I mean, and what's funny is, not funny, but interesting is that, you know, we had these interviews with Willie from the past because we wrote about Willie a lot because, you know, he was a fan favorite when he was playing. So we did stories on him then, and they held up very well because, like I say, Willie is just Willie.
You guys also compiled the list of his greatest moments in his career. Was that a you thing? Was it the entire Cardinal publication staff? Take me through the process of how you came up with that list.
Yeah, I think I came up with the list, and then Steve kind of tweaked it and edited it, and then we kind of looked it over and got it to the point where everybody agreed on it.
That's got to be fun, just going back. And because I'm sure when you're going through those, in many ways, you're reliving them.
Yeah, you know, and with Willie, he had so many moments, you know, it's definitely fun.
The foreword is written by his very close friend, Ozzie Smith, and I thought it was really well done. I really appreciated Ozzie's words that are in the yearbook, and I didn't realize that Willie stayed living with Ozzie for as long as he did at the early part of his career.
For the first, I think he was traded. He came up in May of 81, and I think he lived with the Smiths, because Ozzie was married at the time, through the end of the 82, mm-hmm. 82 season. And, you know, and then when Vince Coleman comes up in 85, Willie does the same thing for him and brings in and Vince Coleman to live with him for a while. And, yeah.
It's so Ozzie writes the foreword, and then you've got all these toasts from so many different individuals. What was it like for you guys? I mean, this is a lot of, I got to think the work involved in getting in touch with all these people was something I could count, but I mean, it's a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely take some time, but the one thing about it is they all love talking about Willie. So that made it easy. You know, I mean, I enjoy talking with Don Mattingly, who, you know, was a teammate of Willie in 81 in AA Nashville. And then 4 years later, Don Mattingly is MVP of the American League and Willie is MVP of the National League. So that's a pretty cool connection they have.
You learn so much about somebody when you hear like other people talking about him, if that makes sense, or read what other people are talking about. And it's just, it's great. So people really should get a copy of this. But like, just from a behind the scenes standpoint, can you talk through the work that goes into this, like how long this takes, and from start to finish, from the initial idea that this is what the yearbook's going to be this year to eventually, you know, being able to hold an actual copy of it?
Well, I mean, it's really hard to say exactly how long it takes, but I would say one thing that for me, who just does the writing, that probably goes unnoticed is just how difficult or how much time it takes to come up with the great photos, you know? I mean, because there's so many photos, and so the photo, you know, editing the photos is a big deal for that.
It is really something cool. So if folks want to get their hands on one of these, and every Cardinal fan listening should, what's the best way to do that?
The best way right now, since the season is over and there's no more home games anyway, is to go online to cardinals.com/publications, and you can see a free preview. We also got Willie to sign a bunch of copies, and those will be going out to random people who buy the yearbook.
Okay.
So if you go online and buy it that way, you got a shot at that. You know, that's going to take a while, but get in there and might get a signed copy.
Very good. So you never know. All of a sudden, you look at his signature. Is that real? Yeah, that's real.
That's definitely real.
That is Willie McGee's autograph. So, and while you're there, you can go ahead and just get a subscription to Cardinals Magazine all at the same time.
Absolutely. You know, you can get a free preview of this issue with Von Herrera on the cover and a nice send off to John Mozeliak.
Yeah, I think we're going to try to get Mark on next week. He wrote the cover story for the most recent Cardinals magazine. Stan, this is you know how much I think of what you guys do and how much I love the publications, and the yearbook is one of my favorite things. I was able to give a copy to my dad. When I got a copy, I said, hey, can I get a second one? And I gave a copy of it to my dad.
He's probably from the era of big Willie McGee fans.
So he just started indulging it, right? We're at lunch and he's like reading through it. So, I mean, it's a really, really cool thing.
One cool thing about this is that the general manager, what's his name, was Whitey's GM when Willie was traded. He's like 95 years old now, Joe McDonald.
Yeah.
And he reached out to us to say how much he enjoyed it, you know.
That's cool.
He's living in Lakeland, Florida. So, yeah, that was nice for him to reach out.
Stan, thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Matt. Thanks for having me.
That is Stan McNeil. Again, you can get a copy, cardinals.com/publications, the Cardinal Yearbook, Forever 51, a salute to the most beloved Cardinal of the last 50 years, Willie McGee. You're going to want to check it out for yourself. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll wrap up hour number one. It's the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. It's Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. Just a couple minutes left in hour number one. Hour number two will be shortened as we'll be taking you till about 7:45. That's when our coverage of Cardinals baseball begins. The Cardinals and the Giants tonight, opening up a three-game midweek series. They'll have Thursday off, and then they'll wrap up the season with three games in Chicago against the Cubs coming up this weekend. The wild card race is interesting right now in the National League. If the season were to end right now, the Cincinnati Reds would be a playoff club because they have the tiebreaker against the Mets. Each team is sitting at 80-76. And then, you know, the Diamondbacks, who are just one game back, the Giants are three games back. So the Giants are not completely out of this. They're mostly out of it. But the Cardinals could certainly make sure that San Francisco is not a playoff club if they can have some success. And, you know, they take two out of three from the Brewers. And the Brewers have some issues right now. They just put Brandon Woodruff on the injured list. We saw William Contreras get a little bit banged up. And if there's one criticism of that team, it's whether or not they are built for a postseason run. And you just look at some of the stuff that's going on with them, and you don't know. And as much as the Brewers have done over, you know, recent years and just played above their skis, they've never had a year like this. It's a 95 win team right now with 1 week left in the season, and they from an overall standpoint, they are three games better than any other team in baseball, and that's the Philadelphia Phillies. So it has been impressive for Milwaukee. You hated the fact that they celebrated at Busch Stadium, and if you saw any of the photos of it, that carpet in the visiting clubhouse looked like a lake. It didn't look like anything else. So they're probably on the hook for some carpet replacement there in the visiting clubhouse, and I'm sure they think that it is well worth it. If there's one thing though, you like the fact that they won the division on a Cubs loss, not on a win against the Cardinals. The Cardinals did what they were supposed to do yesterday. They won that game. Cubs lost. That put the Brewers into a division championship mode, but it was not a beat the Cardinals and then celebrate. I don't know how much that helps with anything, but at the very least, they did not beat the Cardinals to become division champions yesterday. They won the division thanks to something that was happening elsewhere in the division. All right, we'll talk Mizzou football. Gabe DeArmond's going to join us after the 7 o'clock news. Stick with us. It's Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
It's the Gray Bar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. Eventful last few days for Missouri football. They got a good win against South Carolina. They find out their SEC rivalry opponents for the next handful of years. A lot of weekly honors coming to the Tigers today. Talk about all that and more. Very happy to welcome on to the program. You read him at PowerMizzou.com. He is Gabe DeArmond. Gabe, thanks for taking some time with us today. How are you?
Not bad. What's going on?
Not much. So let's jump in. I guess we'll go kind of backwards all the way in, but we'll start with the news of today with Mizzou having their three annual opponents set in the SEC for the next 4 years. It's Arkansas, it's Oklahoma, and it's Texas A&M. What was your initial thoughts to those being the schools that Missouri will see every year for the next handful of years?
Yeah, two of those were sure things. We knew Arkansas and Oklahoma would happen. A&M was a little bit of a surprise. I kind of thought maybe South Carolina, but I think it probably, and I don't know if we'll get an answer to this or not, was a little bit of a competitive balance thing, trying to even out schedules, and there's no perfect way to do it. I know A&M doesn't seem super thrilled that Missouri's the third. I'm not sure Missouri fans are all that happy that A&M's the third, but that's the way it goes. You'll go play who you play and move along.
Is part of it that you squint and it's two teams that used to be in the Big 12, so you can at least rationalize it out that way?
Well, that's kind of my thing, is it's them and Oklahoma and A&M, and it's like, were we just doing the Big 12 thing here? Like, I thought the point of the SEC was to do some different stuff and, you know, maybe get, like, you know, there's Oklahoma Ole Miss. That's kind of cool. Maybe get, like, a Missouri South Carolina or an A&M you know, I think A&M maybe wanted Arkansas, but just change them up a little bit so you weren't going quite the geographic old conferences. But again, it's hard to do. Not everybody was ever going to be happy. There are some games they really wanted to protect. And the other thing is you're playing everybody over a four-year period twice anyway, so you get to see all those teams. It's really only two extra games.
All right, so let's get into the game a little bit. They find a way to beat South Carolina. The rushing difference between the two, Missouri 285 rushing yards, South Carolina negative 9. So Missouri is what, plus 294 in rushing in the game compared to their opponent. I don't know if I've seen that. That's got to be one of the, in terms of SEC games, you just don't see that very often. How good was Missouri, especially from a rushing standpoint against South Carolina?
Yeah, the funny thing is, and that is more pronounced than usual, but I mean, that's been the biggest difference in this series. Missouri's won 6 out of 7, and in those 7 games, they've outrushed South Carolina by an average of 191 to 55. You know, South Carolina's, I think, only topped 100 yards once or twice in those 7 years. Missouri's topped 200 or 194 times, so they've run the ball really well against them. Look, Ahmad Hardy is everything that was advertised. Jamal Roberts, I think, is probably better than most of us expected. I think the team expected him to be really good. I'm not sure I expect him to be as good as he has been. And then you add Bo Prabula in there and what he can do with his feet. He had 70-some-odd yards on Saturday night. I mean, they've got a pretty potent running game.
Going into the game, it felt like the Missouri fans that were worried about this game were worried about it because of the line play against South Carolina, and then those worries got that much more accentuated when we learned that Caden Green wasn't going to be a play. As you watched this game, what did you think about what Missouri did? Obviously, the rushing yards speak for themselves, but how did Missouri, from a lineman standpoint, offensive line and defensive line for that matter, stack up against South Carolina?
Yeah, they controlled the line of scrimmage, no question, on both sides. I mean, they had 5 sacks. They were all over Lenora Sellers. Bo Prabula only got sacked once. So Missouri controlled that part of the game. I think, honestly, the only reason there was to be really nervous about that game was, hey, what if Lenora Sellers suddenly plays like he did last year? And this is a weird series and strange things have happened. And strange things happen, no question, because Missouri dominated the game and they were down with 10 minutes left.
Bo Prabula, the you know, final line isn't anything impressive. 16 of 27, 171 yards, 1 touchdown, 1 interception. But late in the game, he made the plays that they needed him to make. And sometimes, especially when you're going as well as they were going on the ground, if that's what you ask of your quarterback, if they're able to do it, well, then that's going to help you out and that's going to result in a win.
Yeah, look, Missouri has won a lot of games that they just kind of wait for you to beat yourself. and they don't beat themselves a whole lot, you know. So I think I think that's a good quality to have. And Prabula was not spectacular, but he was pretty good. You know, I would say 264 yards of total offense, something like that. And like I said, just doesn't beat his team.
You look at the individual honors. Ahmad Hardy's the SEC Offensive Player of the Week. Offensive lineman Keegan Trost, Offensive Lineman of the Week. Zion Young is the co-defensive lineman of the week. Robert Meyer, co-freshman of the week from a coordinator standpoint. Another honor for Kirby Moore, their offensive coordinator, CBS Sports, naming him their SEC SEC coordinator of the week. It really felt like a lot of people took notice of some of these individual performances, that and it feels like that's a, when you see all these honors coming down, it makes the win almost feel that much bigger.
Yeah, and you know, Ahmad Hardy's starting to get a little Heisman buzz. Everybody's noticing Bo Prabula, putting him on the best transfer list. I think people are really starting to take notice of Josiah Trotter and Damon Wilson now. So they've got a lot of guys here. And, you know, I think there were two questions about Missouri coming in. They were kind of related. Everybody said, do they have a quarterback? Well, we know they have a quarterback now. And they don't just have a quarterback. They have a quarterback that's better than any quarterback they've had here for a little bit, I think. And secondly was, how do you replace Burden and Weiss and Armand Membo and all these pieces you lost on the offense? But I said all summer, you were replacing names. Like, their offense wasn't actually all that good last year. So you were replacing names more than you were replacing production.
Gabe DeArmond from Power Mizzou is continuing to join us. So through the first four games, you have a rivalry game in there against Kansas. You got your first SEC game in there against South Carolina, a couple games that you were supposed to win by a lot, and you end up losing them by a lot. Has this first month of the season pretty much gone as well as it, beyond just being 4-0, but looking, you know, beyond that, has this first 4 weeks gone pretty much as well as it could go for Missouri?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they've dominated four games now. Like Eli Drinkwitz said, they didn't dominate two of them on the scoreboard, and that's the next step, is fixing the pass coverage and, you know, avoiding some of these big plays. But look, they're clearly a better team than South Carolina, clearly a better team than Kansas. I think we knew that going into those games, but you still have to go do it. And then they've got one more layup here, and then the last 7 weeks of the season is we really find out about this team and where it can go.
This is the ongoing conversation, and I don't know when this conversation is going to end, but there continues to be parties within the SEC that looks down at Mizzou. I saw the you had retweeted it over at the Power Mizzou Twitter account from Texas A&M coach Mike Elko talking about Missouri being one of their annual opponents, and clearly not real happy with that. And I don't know, I feel like there's almost a hint of disrespect towards Missouri. This team, obviously, you look at what they've done over the last few years with a win total standpoint, everything, they belong in this league. They belong in the national conversation. What in the world is it going to take for the rest of the league and people in the rest of the SEC markets to start to accept that?
Well, there's a couple things at play here. First of all, you're never accepted in the SEC. Arkansas and South Carolina have been in this thing for 33 years, and they're still not accepted in the SEC. Arkansas and South Carolina liked Missouri coming in because they were the new kid now, and Arkansas and South Carolina weren't the new kid. Other fans are never going to respect your team. I mean, that's part of it. There's a lot of fan media in the SEC, more so than I think other leagues, so I think that's a part of it. And then I think a part of it is Missouri fans go around looking for people who don't respect them. Mm-hmm. Like, I really think that Missouri fans spend a lot of time worried about what other people think and go and find the people that don't think highly enough of them. Like, Mike Elko, I don't think by any means was saying, hey, Missouri's not worthy of being our opponent, not in this league. I think he was saying, I think the fans wanted Arkansas, you know, and I think there are some people that, and that's fine because I don't think Missouri fans really want to Texas A&M either. You know, that's part of it. I don't know. I'll be honest. I get really tired of the win, are they going to like us conversation.
Yeah.
Go win. They don't like you when you win. You know who everybody likes in this league? Vanderbilt. They like them less now than they did 2 years ago. You know, I've told Missouri fans for like 5 years, you got to get over it. You got to quit worrying about what they think. Go win a bunch of games. You know, like, they respected Missouri in a hurry when they came in here and went to two SEC title games in 3 years.
Fair enough. They've got UMass coming up this weekend. That's a game they should dominate. And then Alabama after that. I know you don't want to look over your opponents, but at the same time, this is kind of a weird time in the schedule to be playing a team like UMass.
Yeah, it actually, I think, works out really well for Missouri. Like, I don't like the six straight home games. I think it gives you a really tough second half of the season with four out of six on the road. But if it had to be, you basically got scrimmage, big game against Kansas. Scrimmage, big game against South Carolina. Scrimmage, off week, big game against Alabama. I mean, if you have to play six straight home games, it worked out pretty well. And Missouri can absolutely overlook UMass. Like, look, they could play a D game and win this game. UMass lost to Bryant 2 weeks ago. They've been outscored by 70 some odd points. They're the worst team probably in all of FBS football. So Missouri can absolutely overlook this game.
He is Gabe DeArmond from Power Mizzou. PowerMizzou.com, they're part of the 24/7 Sports Network, which is the best when it comes to recruiting and everything that goes along with that. And the Mizzou coverage at Power Mizzou is absolutely fantastic. Gabe, thank you so much for taking some time with us. Hopefully we can chat again down the line.
All right, sounds good. Thanks for having me.
That's Gabe DeArmond from Power Mizzou and PowerMizzou.com. We appreciate him taking a little bit of time with us. We'll take a break. Again, we are, y'all set for Cardinals baseball tonight as our coverage is going to begin later on this hour from the Cardinals Radio Network. Cardinals beginning the final week of the regular season, starting with a three-game series in San Francisco against the Giants. We'll take a break. Have more in just a moment. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. We're back at it here at KMOX. It is a Graybar Sports Open Line. My name is Matt Pauly. Have you for about another 20, 22 minutes or so before we get out of here and get you ready for coverage from the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network. It is being reported Cardinals are in San Francisco tonight. They are going to match up against the Giants, and there has been a lineup change this evening for the Cardinals as Brendan Donovan has been scratched. He is evidently feeling some stiffness and some soreness. That's according to reporting from Derek Gould from the Post-Dispatch. So Donovan is not going to be in there. Instead, Jose Fermin is going to move into the starting lineup at second base. You know, they had the decision to make on Mason Winn, on just keeping him on the roster and trying to play him. I don't think we've gotten to that point yet with Donovan, but we have seen him be somebody who can't be in the lineup every single day dealing with that stiffness and soreness. More than anything else, you just want to make sure that these guys are as healthy as possible going into the offseason and go from there, especially for a guy like Donovan who is possibly going to get traded. Like I talked about this yesterday or earlier today. I mentioned the fact that Nolan Arenado is likely to be traded. And what I said earlier was like, we need to talk in reality. You might not want Arenado to get traded, and I understand why you don't want Arenado to get moved. I understand why you would want Arenado back with the Cardinals next year, but it's a moot conversation at this point. When the organization is where it's at, and when Arenado is speaking as openly as he is yesterday in the clubhouse about it probably being best for him to be elsewhere, and it felt like his final game, the writing is very much on the wall. So instead of, like, my take on this is, instead of wasting time on the conversation on if he should be traded, I think the better conversation is, what is it going to look like when he gets traded? What does that look like specifically at third base? And I'll tell you something. I not to pat myself on the back, but I do take pride in the fact that I don't hunker down with takes and just stick with it because I'm not willing to be flexible. I have been singing the praises of Nolan Gorman for much of the year post June 1st. If you listen to me a lot, you've heard me cite his post June 1st numbers. What we have seen from Gorman in the last month to me is startling. It's startling because I was starting to feel like we were finally seeing who Nolan Gorman was. Because you can take his numbers from about June 1st into August. I don't know the exact date that you would have to cut it off. But into August, and he was arguably the second or third best hitter for the Cardinals behind Burleson and behind Contreras. And since then, here as the as we have gone into the month of September, it's really gone bad for him again. And this has been the thing where I have said, okay, can you trust this guy? And I'm not sure if you can. So I'm backing off my praise of Nolan Gorman just because I have been very frustrated. I was all in on him there for a while. And in the month of June, he had an 867 OPS. In the month of July, he had a 742 OPS. In the month of August, he had a 721 OPS. That's fine. I know people are going to get locked in on the batting average. I know people are going to get locked in on the strikeouts. That OPS is average to above average. Perfectly fine. There is nothing wrong with the numbers that Gorman put up in June, July, and August. So we did the whole thing of, you know, he's working on his swing with Brant Brown, and he kind of got what he wanted to do down, so he took some bat speed away to work on it, and eventually got the bat speed back up, and then that took us to June 1st, and that's who he was. And then in September, he's got a 418 OPS to go along with the other bad numbers, a 138 batting average, 28 strikeouts, and 58 at-bats. So he's striking out half the time. He's got just a bad OPS, and he's got a bad batting average. There is nothing redeeming about his month of September. One home run in the 58 at-bats. That is a startling final month of the season. Arguably the most important month of his career, because he was playing himself for a job next year. And Kevin Wheeler and I were having this conversation. I can't remember if we had this conversation on the air or off the air. Because Kevin said earlier to me, well, Arnau's going to be gone next year. You just put him at third and you just let him play there every day. And I'm not there with him right now. I have a hard time knowing why this is going to be different than what it's been before. And is there a possibility that I'm being a little bit hard on him right now? Is there a possibility that this month of September is just a bad month? He's in a slump, and he really is the guy that we saw in June, July, and August. Yeah, I'm open to that. But we really needed to see more from him in the month of September, and he looks very similar to how he looked last year when he ended up getting sent back to AAA. So that brings us to the, well, then who plays third? If Arenado's gone, which I think he will be, if Arenado's gone, and if Gorman you can't trust, and maybe he's going to be gone as well, what does that do? Is J.J. Weatherholt your third baseman? I think he might be. We'll question the defense for Weatherholt. I think there's going to be probably some growing pains there. But I was never bothered by Gorman's defense too much. I mean, when he first started playing third, obviously at that moment in time, that was not sustainable. He needed to be better, but he got better to his credit, and I thought he would. And Weatherholt's a guy who's probably, he's going to be fine over there. He's not going to be Arenado, but he'd be fine. But is there a scenario that plays out where Weatherholt's your third baseman, and maybe they don't even trade Donovan, and Donovan stays at second, and you move on from Gorman, and you move on from Newt Barr, and you move on from some, you know, you find another lefty bat to maybe move on for. Like, that's a possibility. But the foregone conclusion that Arenado leaves, Gorman takes over at third, I don't think that's a foregone conclusion right now. I'm not there. Maybe the organization feels differently than I feel, but I am concerned by what we have seen in the month of September from Gorman. And the reason most people don't like Gorman, the batting average and the strikeouts, that's not the big part of this for me. I'm accepting of a low batting average. I'm accepting of a certain number of strikeouts without going past a certain threshold. But to go along with that, I need slug. I need home runs. I need doubles. And that is essentially non-existent from Gorman right now. And if you're not getting that, in his 58 at-bats in the month of September, he has two doubles and one home run and a slugging percentage of .224. And on base, and I need walks. I need walks. That's, you got a power hitter. You need somebody who's going to walk. Well, he's not walking. He's got four walks in the month of September and an on-base percentage below 200. So it's been a real struggle for Gorman here in the month of September. One more break. We'll come back, and we're going to wrap up the program and then get into coverage of Cardinals baseball. Cardinals, Giants tonight, more in a moment. It's the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. Back at it on the Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. Have you on this program for a little bit less than 10 more minutes, and then we are going to be out of here, and we'll get to Cardinals baseball as our coverage tonight begins at 7:50. Cardinals and Giants coming up tonight. 314-436-7900. 314-436-7900. That's a call. That's a text. You can tweet at me as well if you'd like, at Matt Pauly on air. For those of you who are watching the video stream of today's show, you can leave a comment on there and we can get into that. Got a text message from Robert that says, I agree with your feelings about Gorman. I've been really surprised at how poorly Gorman has hit in September. He is simply not being able to hit the baseball, period. He just cannot make contact. It's very disappointing. Too bad. You know, there have been players this season. I'm going to use, we have a, the runway is starting to end on our ability to use the word runway. I hope they do not run it back on a runway for next year. So, there have been players who have benefited from the quote unquote runway season. Alec Burleson has benefited from the runway season. Matthew Liberatore has benefited from the runway season. Ivan Herrera, and really those guys, not so much Liberatore. Liberatore is probably the poster child for the positive impact of the runway season this year. Whether it's a runway year or not, Alec Burleson and Ivan Herrera were going to have a spot on the roster and they were going to have playing time and things like that. But they were put into a position where the environment that was there would not really adding to the roster created room for them to make sure that they had time. Although, like with Burleson, he really wasn't playing much at the beginning of the season. It took a little while for him to find something. So, okay, all that being said, I'm not saying the idea of the runway season has been a failure. There's in the relief pitching, we've seen a lot of guys get bigger opportunities, and it's been good for them. But who are we talking about? Who were the two individuals that we were talking about the runway season when the season got started? All through spring training, all at the beginning of the year, there were two players that we mentioned over and over and over ad nauseum. Just that's all. That was the single narrative that existed around St. Louis Cardinals baseball. It was Walker and Gorman. So where are we at right now in evaluating those two individuals? In the last segment, if you just joined us, I was talking about Gorman's September and how I've been really, really disappointed with what we've seen and what I would have described as the most important month of his career, coming off a really solid June, July, August. He has just fallen off the cliff at a point in time in this organization where there's going to be a spot for him, and now you don't know if you want to give that spot to him. So that's the first thing. And then Jordan Walker, there has been no player more disappointing this season than Jordan Walker. He has statistically been one of the worst players in all of baseball. He's got a sub-600 OPS. He's got a 582 OPS for the season. And put this into perspective, we've still got, what, a week and a half left in the month of September, a little bit more than a week. Of Walker's last three games, he's got two-hit games. So he's got four hits in his last three games. He's still, in the month of September, is a 186 hitter with a 495 OPS. So you have a tiny sample size that is the 15 games that he's played in September, and two of his last three games, he's put up really good numbers, 2-for-4 and 2-for-3. And the numbers in the month of September are still just absolutely terrible. And this followed a month of August where he had a 539 OPS, following a month of July wasn't terrible for him. July was okay. But the point of the matter is, nothing can be guaranteed for Walker next season. And that's going to be, we're going to hear from Heim Bloom at some point next week. There's going to be a press conference, or there is going to be press conferences. I don't know what the plan is for the Cardinals. I have no idea. I don't know if they're going to do a end of season thing on Monday and just immediately start looking forward to the next season with Heim. I don't know if we'll hear from Mo one more time and then hear from. I have no indication of what it is going to look like. So if they decide to do a couple things, we may hear from Heim later in the week. If they decide to do just one thing, I would think we'll hear from Heim earlier in the week. But one way or another, in the next 10 days or so, we are going to hear from Heim Bloom. And I would be very hopeful that inside of that press conference and inside of those conversations, and hopefully we get a chance to maybe talk with him on a one-on-one basis, we can start to understand what they are looking at for next year. Is they don't have the expectation of competing at the highest level next year. We know that. We also know that this thing that they're going through to get back to being a team that does compete at the highest level is going to be a multi-year thing. At the same time, as much as it feels like they're a gazillion miles away from being a legitimate World Series contender, they're a bounce here and a bounce there away from being a playoff club. They're right there. They're four games out. Could have they won four more games if they would have gotten rid of Fetty earlier and gone to McGreevy? Would they won four more games if they wouldn't have sold off at the deadline? Would have they won four more games if they would have made some other tweaks as the season went along? Like, you don't have to squint very hard at all to see the 2025 Cardinals as a playoff club. But if they're a playoff club, barring something miraculous happening, which does happen sometimes, but hope can't be a strategy. Barring something miraculous happening, if they would have been a playoff club this year, they would have snuck in and probably had an early exit. That's probably what their ceiling was this year. Their ceiling, that was their ceiling. I have no problem stating. The ceiling for the 2025 Cardinals was just sneaking into the postseason and not going on a playoff run. So they fell short of the ceiling, but they didn't fall that short of the ceiling. They're right there. You would think that they can kind of be in the exact same place next year if they want to be. Maybe they can add to the roster a little bit. But that's the goal isn't just to sneak into the postseason. The goal is to build this organization back to being a team that can win the World Series. And I know, look, there's a lot of people listening to my voice right now that are either actually yelling at the radio or in their head are yelling at the radio because they don't think this organization is actually on that path. That they don't think that 2-3 years down the line, they can actually be a team that's going to be competing at the highest level. I would push back on that. I've also said this before. My belief, and I have no inside information on this whatsoever. What Heim Bloom went through in Boston with a meddling owner and an owner that put him in a bad spot, I don't think he takes this job without getting certain assurances going into this season. And I think he's going to be able to do things, for the most part, the way he wants to do them. For me, that's part of the reason that I think there's more confidence about moving on from Arenado, where the organization may have shuddered at the idea of eating some of Arenado's contract last year. I would say that it might be a little bit of a different situation this year. We'll continue this conversation throughout the coming days and weeks and months, as that's a large part of what the offseason is going to look like. But the offseason isn't here yet. We've got Cardinals baseball tonight. Cardinals open up a 3-game midweek series in San Francisco. They take on the Giants. Our coverage from the Cardinals Radio Network will begin in about 5 minutes right here on KMOX.